Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with whether or not the overt and inherently racist re-election campaign Trump is running will find enough voters to afford him a slim victory in November. With Trump demonizing minorities in the Black Lives Matter movement, portraying them as dangerous looters out to burn down white suburbia, as he stokes racial division and hatred in order to benefit from it, we will assess what strategies can be employed to calm white fear and speak with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity and the author of the new book Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. He joins us to discuss how to neutralize the Republican strategy of inflaming racial tensions about and among minorities, which he sees as the GOP's agenda of distraction from the fact they are giving away the country to rich donors. He offers a plan to defeat this racist power grab, which is available at raceclassacademy.com. Then we'll look further into the deficit of strategy on the part of the Democrats, who appear to be making the same mistakes Hillary Clinton made in not understanding that they are up against a ruthless criminal who is portrayed by his former lawyer and fixer in his new book out today as a wannabe mafia boss. Vitaly Mogadem, a professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University and author of The Psychology of Dictatorship and Threat to Democracy, The Appeal of Authoritarianism in an Age of Uncertainty, joins us to discuss how the liberal pundits are making a mistake in dismissing Trump's enablers in the GOP as members of a cult. Instead, he argues that they share Trump's dangerous politics and authoritarian personality, believing that morality is obedience. This, combined with the anti-science and anti-fact nature of the propaganda machinery of Fox News, means it is time for the Democrats to get tough and tell it like it is. Then finally, with House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and other leading Republican senators urging Trump to stop trashing mail-in balloting because he is scaring off seniors who vote for the GOP, we will speak with Dr. Michael McDonald, a professor of political science at the University of Florida, who is the director of the United States Election Project. He joins us to discuss how Trump is using the phony controversy over mail-in ballots as a cover if he loses to Joe Biden in November. And before we begin, I'd like to pay my respects to the first producer of this radio program back during the Reagan administration, Michael Rose, who passed away this weekend. He is greatly missed. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity. Since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law, he remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, he's the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. And his latest book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Glad to join you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And at the risk of sounding like a hyperventilating liberal clutching my pearls, there is this anxiety out there, in spite of Biden's lead in the polls, that Trump could still pull this off. And the fact that he is overtly racist now, he's both stirring up racial strife and then profiting from it or benefiting from it, and is clearly going to continue to do this through till November. Do you think that there is enough racists in this country to vote for him, or enough nervous white suburbanites worried about public safety that might fall for this cynical ploy that Trump is using to demonize Black Lives Matter and Antifa, etc., to suggest that they're out to burn down white suburbs?
I think that it becomes very important to be clear in our own minds what we mean when we say that Trump is racist. Is he racist? Yes, in the sense that he's strategically manipulating intense fears that are inseparably connected to racist stereotypes. That's a form of racism. I think we should call it strategic racism. We should denounce it as strategic racism, or you could use words like fear-mongering, hate-mongering, demagoguery. All of those apply to Trump. But at the same time, we should be clear that he does this using language that, while it triggers intense fears rooted in racist stereotypes, is designed so that most people think that their fears are common sense and not racism. Trump is not trying to win over a base of closet Klan members, and progressives who think that are delusional. There's a sort of a laziness to progressives who are like, anybody supports Trump is a racist Klan member. No, they're not. They're almost half of your fellow citizens. So stop with that nonsense and think about what Trump is saying. Trump is saying you got to worry about law and order. You got to worry about anarchists, you have to worry about terrorists and gangbangers and criminal illegals. We know and should know, or should know, those warnings are rooted in an intentional effort to manipulate racist stereotypes. But most Americans don't hear them that way. And I really want to emphasize that point. And I'm not just saying that. I've done research on this. I ran a major research project in 2017, 2018. I just finished another one in July. Here's what I know. Majorities of Democrats, majorities of union households, majorities of African Americans, and majorities of Latinos all find a message that says we need to worry about illegals, we need to worry about China, we need to worry about terrorists. They find that message convincing. They are not Klan members. They're average Americans. And we need to understand that Trump is messaging to these folks in a way that stirs up racist stereotypes that almost every one of us holds. But at the same time, he's doing it in a way that convinces people that he's not intentionally provoking racism, but is instead saying things that are common sense.
Well, but in terms of Trump being a racist or not, it's pretty clear that he is, isn't it? I mean, from his niece Mary's book, and now you've got Michael Cohen's book, in which Trump disparages Nelson Mandela and says, tell me a country run by a black person that isn't an asshole. They are all complete expletive toilets. And then in terms of blacks and Hispanics, Trump said that, I will never get the Hispanic vote like the blacks. They're too stupid to vote for Trump. They're not my people. And I haven't read Cohen's book. It's out today, but apparently it paints a pretty vivid picture of a very hateful racist. And what did he do when he first announced his running for president?
Yeah, so there are many different forms of racism. Trump checks off a lot of those. But we have to ask ourselves, what is it that makes Trump's racism so dangerous, right? Like you can imagine someone who holds prejudiced views, but is, you know, frankly, Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson grew up in the South, in Texas, held prejudiced views, and yet pushed for and signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. What makes Trump dangerous is not that he's got this long history of personal prejudice or even bigotry against people of color. What makes him dangerous to society? What makes him dangerous to people of color? What makes him lethal to democracy is that he is intentionally, coldly, calculatedly stirring racial conflict in the United States for his own personal profit. This is how he builds political power. That is, this is the difference between someone who may be a bigot but tries hard to keep that out of public policy and someone who instead has organized their political campaign and their governance style around giving effect to racist fears. That's Trump. And I think that when we look to, like, what is the danger he poses, and also what is the best strategy for defeating him, we need to be crystal clear that the main threat we face is someone who intentionally promotes division. And the best strategy is to name intentional division as something that threatens all of us, whether we're brown or black or white, and to name coming together, building bridges across racial differences, as the best way to fight back.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, he's the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. And his latest book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. So then, is this incumbent upon Joe Biden to call Trump out on this cynical racist ploy of his to stir up racial division, divide America, and scare white suburbia into voting for him? It's pretty transparent what he's doing.
I so wish Biden would. But instead, I think that Biden is making a mistake that Democrats have made in the past. If the message from the right, from Trump, but from Republicans, and this is a message that they've been broadcasting for 50 years, if their message is people of color are dangerous, we'll protect you. Sometimes you see Democrats take up that very same message. They moderate it somehow a little bit. They say people of color are dangerous, we'll protect you, we just won't be extreme. Right. So you can imagine somebody saying, we won't fund the border wall, but we'll fund billions in border security. Or Joe Biden right now running these ads on Law and Order saying, you know, anarchists are wrong, protest is wrong. And you could be forgiven for thinking that was a Trump ad. Biden needs to say as clearly as he can, people of color are not the danger we face in this country. It's greedy elites like Donald Trump intentionally pushing racial conflicts so that we fear and fight each other rather than confront the way the billionaire class is rigging the system for themselves. That's Joe Biden's message. That's the Democratic message. That's the message that builds cross-racial, class-conscious solidarity, a message that says division is being intentionally promoted. Racist conflict is being intentionally promoted by greedy elites so that we will fear and fight each other. We need to reject division, build solidarity across differences, come together and make sure government works for all of us, whatever our race, whatever our color, whatever our immigration status.
Well, I can certainly see Bernie Sanders saying that. I'm not sure about Joe Biden. But in terms of providing Trump with the images that he uses in commercials to show burning buildings and looting and burning and disorder, which is often being done by white provocateurs, by the way. But nevertheless, is there any way that the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, can sort of stop demonstrating and start registering kids to vote? Because there's an awful lot of young people from all races joining in the Black Lives Matter movement. And it would seem to me that that activism and energy would be much better spent registering kids to vote rather than providing Trump with visual ammunition.
Well, I think that I'm a big admirer of the movement for Black Lives and its many different facets. And one of the things that I admire the most is that it really is a holistic movement. It's a movement that says, we need to engage in protest, but we also need to engage in electoral politics. We need to focus on racial justice, but we also need to focus on economic justice. We also need to think about patriarchy. We need to think about transphobia. I think that there's this such a grand vision of social systems that have failed us and the need to remake those social systems along many different dimensions that I think is really admirable and I think is a hallmark of this new generation of protesters. But I think you also named something that Black Lives Matter, they simply don't have control over, which is agents provocateurs within the protests who are busy setting fires and, throwing things at police. They don't have control of that. And they don't have control over the way in which the media tends to focus on violence without giving adequate attention to the pro-social activities of the movement for Black Lives. And, one example of this, I think about the way in which the Movement for Black Lives has tried to encourage cross-racial solidarity, has tried to say we're all in this fight by recognizing the value, the human value of Black lives. We recognize the human value of all our lives. And yet that's a message that the media almost entirely ignores. Not a surprise. I mean, what the Movement for Black Lives is trying to do is fight a deeply entrenched cultural common sense in which white lives have value and the lives of people of color have less value. And in that context, you know, there's always this sort of this mismatch between what the mainstream is saying and interpreting and what they see and what these insurgent groups are trying to do. But I think all of us can help build a better society by essentially really engaging with what these new insurgent groups are trying to do. Look up Movement for Black Lives on the web, read their policy statements, follow their Twitter feeds, go to their protests, engage in their different pro-social activities, join the movement. One of the things that I loved was that so many of the protests all across the country were multiracial, and in many of them, whites outnumbered African Americans. That's what a movement for Black lives ought to look like, because all of us need to be involved in it, partly because it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do, to recognize our shared humanity, but also because Donald Trump and the Republicans and their corporate backers are intentionally trying to cast Black lives as a mortal enemy. And if we believe those lies, the rich, Donald Trump, the Mercers, the Koch brothers, Fox News, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, they will continue to run society for their own benefit while laughing at all the rest of us as we fight each other. That is, every one of us has a pragmatic interest in joining the Movement for Black Lives by saying we will not be divided. We will insist on the shared humanity, the human worth of every one of us, no matter what our color is.
Well, I sure would like to hear Joe Biden say exactly what you just said, because it does seem that we really have a problem here. And I, as I said, all of my liberal friends are just still nervous in spite of Biden's lead in the polls. And there are reasons to be nervous. Putin is out there. He'll pull out all the stops. So will Trump. You'll have these white militia guys with their assault rifles showing up at the polls for sure. God knows what's going to happen with mail-in voting with that dreadful guy that Trump put in as the postmaster general. There are all kinds of dirty tricks being played, and unfortunately the Republican Party seems quite willing to go along with any and all forms of voter suppression. So those are the reasons to be worried that Trump could pull out a narrow victory. But the thing that I sort of remind myself of is, am I living in the same America that voted twice for Barack Obama to become president of the United States?
I think that we are living in an America that is deeply steeped in racism. We just can't deny it. That's part of our history. We were moving in the right direction. But I think we ought to be really clear, instead of political leaders who encourage us to be our best selves, we also have political leaders who encourage us to be our most fearful, our worst selves. And frankly, that is the Republican Party. And we need to understand that the Republican Party today has abandoned conservatism. They have embraced big business as their overwhelming constituency. That's who they work for. And in that context, they've embraced demagoguery, scapegoating, and social conflict as their principal route to power. And this is an enormous threat. It's a threat to every family. It's a threat to all of us. It's a threat to our democracy. Frankly, it's a threat to our climate. Everything we're living through right now, these are the forerunners of climate collapse. And yet we have a political party that is so enthralled to corporate interests, in this case to corporate polluters, that they're rolling back environmental protections. Rather than taking us toward a future in which we have a survivable climate, they're they're accelerating our descent into climate collapse. Why? Because it answers the profit motives of the few and sacrifices all the rest of us. We need to see that clearly. We are all in this together. And in order to make that a reality, we need to see the way in which division is actually a weapon against us. And here, let me just interject. I really want to say this. I've recently created a set of short videos to try and explain these concepts, how racism has been weaponized against us, against the idea of liberal government, the way in which standard democratic messages fail to respond, how we can actually build a multiracial movement. I've created short videos along with discussion guides to make these ideas as accessible as possible. They're free. They're online. RaceClassAcademy.com, RaceClassAcademy.com. And I really encourage your listeners, go to their website, take a look at the videos, watch them. No video is longer than 2 minutes and 20 seconds. We all have time for this. And then share them and talk about them. Because, the greatest weapon we face is division. And we have to understand that that's the weapon that's being used against us so that we can see clearly that the route forward, our North Star, is doing the hard work to actually build social solidarity across these divisions so that all of our families can thrive.
RaceClassAcademy.com. Is that it?
That's it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Ian Haney-Lopez.
I really appreciate it, Ian. Thank you for having me on again.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. He's the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. And his latest book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking further into the deficit of strategy on the part of the Democrats, who don't appear to understand that they're up against a ruthless criminal who is portrayed by his former lawyer and fixer as a wannabe mafia boss.
A junkie walking through the twilight. I'm on my way home.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me, or I'll send 1 million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Fatali Mogadam, who is a professor of psychology and the director of the Interdisciplinary Program in Cognitive Science at Georgetown University. He's the editor of Peace and Conflict, Journal of Peace Psychology, and he publishes extensively on radicalization, intergroup conflict, human rights and duties, and The Psychology of Dictatorship and Democracy. And his recent books include The Psychology of Democracy, The Psychology of Dictatorship, The New Global Insecurity, and Threat to Democracy, The Appeal of Authoritarianism in an Age of Uncertainty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fatali Mogadam.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And do you think that the Democrats, and in particular the Democratic punditry, in continuing to refer to the GOP as a party of the cult of personality of Trump, that Trump has in fact sort of captured them as a guru might capture a bunch of acolytes, when in fact the Republican Party isn't a personality cult as much as it is a collection of authoritarian personalities?
Well, that's a very interesting take. I have argued that people like Trump are very dangerous. Trump in particular is a potential dictator. But what makes him very dangerous is the situation we're in. I've discussed the platform that the potential dictator uses, the springboard to dictatorship. Once the springboard is ready, there are always personalities who have the characteristics necessary to become a dictator. So when we go to the 1930s in Germany, the springboard to dictatorship was in place, and a Hitler type was bound to spring forward. And we have the same situation with the Republican Party and Trump at the moment. We have a situation where the springboard to dictatorship has taken shape in the United States, and a Trump-like authoritarian leader was bound to step forward. Now, the one that stepped forward is particularly effective at manipulating the media. And I think that you're absolutely right. The GOP has to be taken very seriously for the ideology it is supporting. And the Democrats have to be very careful to attack in the correct way. So I think your concern is very justified.
But in terms of what you've written about, in terms of the sacred group, is the GOP a collection, as I've mentioned, of authoritarian personalities who take pleasure in belonging to a sacred group? They're submissive to authority, punitive towards minorities, and deferential towards their dear leader and adherents of tradition.
Yes, I believe that's an accurate picture of what is going on. But we have to remember that the sacred group is just a mechanism. The way nationalism is being interpreted and used, the way American identity, white Christian identity, is being weaponized by the GOP, that is a mechanism to achieve certain goals. And the goals are economic more than anything else. The Trump campaign, the Trump movement, has benefited the super rich enormously, and he has promised them additional tax breaks. And of course, they have done nothing at all. They've taken money away from the poor, the bottom 40% in the United States. So the Democrats have to target their opponents very carefully in this era, because the context is still one that is supportive of potential authoritarian leaders such as Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Fatali Mogadam, who is a professor of psychology and director of interdisciplinary program in cognitive science at Georgetown University. He's the editor of Peace and Conflict, Journal of Peace Psychology, and he publishes extensively on radicalization, intergroup conflict, human rights and duties, and the psychology of dictatorship and democracy. And his recent books include The Psychology of Democracy, The Psychology of Dictatorship, The New Global Insecurity, and Threat to Democracy, The Appeal of Authoritarianism in an Age of Uncertainty. So back to my suggestion, Fatali, that the Democrats are making the same mistakes of Hillary Clinton made in not understanding what they're up against. Do you share that concern?
Yes, I do. It's a very grave concern. Of course, in 2016, they could argue that they really didn't know what was coming. But now we do know what's coming, and it is a mistake to target the wrong issues. It seems to me the Democrats have to focus on what is real in the weaknesses of Trump, his terrible, terrible management of the pandemic, his atrocious management of the economy, in addition to all the other issues such as racism, etc. But what's going to ring true for the voters, I believe, is the pandemic, is the economy, is the mismanagement of these big issues by Trump. And of course, he's going to be doing the usual things of distraction, trying to use all kind of distractors to direct attention away so the Democrats fall on the wrong track. So it is a concern. The Democrats have to be very wary. It is a huge balancing act, and they've got to get it right. So I share your concern there.
But beyond my concern about tactics and strategy, or the lack thereof, what concerns me, or what puzzles me, I should say, is in a normal democracy, Trump would have been booted out of office already for the terrible mismanagement of the pandemic and the economy and everything else that you just mentioned. So what keeps him in office? What keeps his base supporting him?
That's an excellent question. That is exactly the question we should be asking. And to answer that question, we have to go back to situations where potential dictators are on the verge of taking over, the springboard to dictatorship is ready, and we have to ask, what makes it ready? What is it that allowed Hitler to spring to power? Well, we come back to the issue of the personality of the dictator on the one hand and the situation on the other hand. Trump is using the White House in a way that it was never used before. He is using the powers of the president in ways that it was never used before. And he is doing it while circumventing law. Basically, he is pushing, tearing up subpoenas, disregarding laws. And the United States has not had this before, has not had to deal with it before, just as Germany in the 1930s had not had to deal with the Hitler character before. They did not know what to do. And the democratic system in Germany collapsed because there were not enough stringent rules and there were not enough frameworks in order to prevent Hitler from breaking out the way he did. We've got the same situation in the United States today. And the problem is that because we have never had a character like Trump disregarding the rules, disregarding how you should behave properly, the Democrats don't know how to react. There aren't enough strong reactions from the Democrats. I was hoping that Harris, who is a law and order person coming from the prosecutor's office, that she would take this up much more directly and point out the illegality of Trump's actions. And that's where they need to head him off.
Well, it's not as if there's a lot of ammunition out there. I mean, you've got the new book out today by Michael Cohen, who was Trump's longtime lawyer and fixer, basically saying he's a mafia boss or a wannabe mafia boss, and that he breaks the laws and breaks the rules. He was tutored, after all, by the mob boss Roy Cohn, and there's been an enormous amount of evidence that have emerged about his dealings with the Russians and with the Brighton Beach mob, buying over 3,000 condos in Trump
yes.
properties. There's a whole history here of this guy being mobbed up, breaking the rules, and, you know, even his own niece has also supported that.
Yes.
So it's not through the lack of ammunition. So why is it nobody can put all of this evidence together that he's a criminal, and there's also a lot of evidence that he's also a traitor? Why can't they put that together and make a coherent message out of it?
Another excellent question. I think it has to do with the fact that nobody has been acting like Trump before, so they don't know what to do about him. And they don't know how to tackle this because they're trying to follow the normal rules of politics in the United States. What they have to do is step out of those rules and form new types of attacks on him. They have to target his base much more directly. They're not doing enough of that. They're doing too much of trying to persuade their own supporters, well, their own supporters already know all this. What they have to do is target his base much more, target fringes of his base, particularly groups of religious supporters who are beginning to break away, the evangelicals who are beginning to fragment. And that is the way to go forward. Attack him directly where his support is. Not keep coming back to the same stories with the liberals who are supporting them.
Well, of course, as I mentioned, he keeps giving them, the Democrats, ammunition. I mean, attacking the military and the veteran community and calling the fallen who served in the military and fought and died for this country suckers and losers. I mean, that would be a gift, wouldn't it, in a normal political battlefield?
Yes, it would in a normal political battlefield. That is not what we have. What we have today is the springboard to dictatorship having taken shape in the United States. The potential dictator is ready to pounce, ready to spring, and this is not normal. And what they have to do is step out of the bounds of the normal behavior that the Democrats have been following. They have to attack in abnormal ways. They have to become much more of an insurgent group, and they have to do it lethally. They've got to be stopping the nice guy's attitude.
Well, you remind me of an American expression, Fatali Mogadam, nice guys finish last.
Well, exactly, and that's what we need. We need attack dogs right now, and much more lethal ones. The Democrats have got to get going in a much more aggressive way, and they have to move very quickly because the election is by far from over, and the results are still very much unknown.
And it's less than 2 months away. So just in the last couple of minutes, are you suggesting then that the Lincoln Project, the group of former Republican operatives, they're doing a much more effective job? Most analysts have suggested maybe they should take over the Democratic campaign.
Absolutely. We need to step outside the bounds of normality here because we're not in a normal situation. I think the Democrats have got to get much more behind the Lincoln Project. They have to get with collaborating with Republicans who are more mainstream and who are sensing the danger, because Trump is not just a danger to the Democrats. He is a danger to principled Republicans. He is a danger to the principles of democracy. And as I said in my book, Threat to Democracy, he is the biggest threat to democracy throughout the world. He is much more a threat to democracy than anyone else, including the leaders of China and Russia, because he is at the heart of America. And if America goes the wrong way, this affects the rest of the world and democracy in the rest of the world.
Well, that is unfortunately one of those nightmare scenarios that I'm hearing from the intelligence community, that this is a brilliant operation by Putin. You know, you don't have to go to war against NATO if you've got a president who's going to pull the United States out of NATO.
Yes, there's no doubt that Putin is the chess master winner in the last 10 years. And also, I would say Trump's presidency has greatly improved the positions of different tin pot dictators around the world, including the extremists in Iran, where I was born. The dictatorship in Iran has become much more radicalized through Trump. And the radicals in Iran are doing very well indeed.
Well, Fatali Mogadam, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Fethullah Mogadam, who's a professor of psychology and the director of the interdisciplinary program in cognitive science at Georgetown University. He's the editor of Peace and Conflict, Journal of Peace Psychology, and he publishes extensively on radicalization, intergroup conflict, human rights and duties, and the psychology of dictatorship and democracy. And his recent books include The Psychology of Democracy, The Psychology of Dictatorship, The New Global Insecurity, and Threat to Democracy, The Appeal of Authoritarianism in an Age of Uncertainty. We're going to take a brief station break and back. Looking into House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and other leading Republican senators are urging Trump to stop trashing mail-in balloting because he's scaring off seniors who vote for the GOP.
Give you my house, and then you go and you throw me out. Send me no letter, I'm getting better.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Michael McDonald, who's a professor of political science at the University of Florida. He's the principal investigator on the Public Mapping Project, a project to encourage public participation in redistricting, and also is the director of the United States Election Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael McDonald.
Good to be with you.
And what do you make of these reports from Axios, where an Axios reporter was traveling with the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy in the western states of California, Oregon, and Washington? And McCarthy told the reporter that he's worried about Trump attacking mail-in voting. And basically he said he sat down with Trump for some time and tried to convince him that the parties will be screwed if he continues his fight against mail-in voting. Just to quote McCarthy, "I tried to show him, you know who is most afraid of COVID? Seniors. And they're not going to go vote. They're not going to go vote, period. And if they're not going to go vote, period, we're screwed." That's a pretty strong message, isn't it?
Well, yes. And this is something that the Trump campaign has obviously had a disconnect with their candidate for some while. The campaign has been encouraging their supporters to cast mail ballots. There have been efforts both through social media and mailers that have been sent directly to Republican supporters of Trump to cast a mail ballot. Many of these have been posted online, so you can actually see what they're doing. And interestingly, they quote Trump, but they blur out part of his tweets in order to make it seem like he supports absentee balloting when he's really been very much against it. I would say that the campaign has had some effect on Trump because he softened his rhetoric on Florida and has said that, well, Florida is okay to vote by mail in Florida because the Republican state government knows what they're doing in Florida. So they've had some success in changing his rhetoric. But at the same time, when you look at the numbers, and we do have data on the party registration of people who are requesting mail ballots in Florida, you see this huge lopsided advantage for the Democrats. And Trump's his messaging or his softening of the rhetoric with Florida really doesn't get through to Florida voters, because what they hear is his continual screeze against mail balloting nationally. And that brief moment of time when he said it was okay to vote by mail in Florida didn't really change particularly Republicans' behavior in Florida. They're continuing to shy away from requesting mail ballots. And, understandably, the campaign's worried because If the Democrats are able to bank a lot of male voters, then they're going to be able to expand their voter mobilization activities and to persuade voters who aren't as strong voters, who don't vote very frequently, to cast their ballots. And that'll help the Democrats to gin up some of their turnout.
And Dr. McDonald, you're in Florida, and the Florida Republican Party is fighting a lawsuit brought by Democrats to relax the state's deadlines for returning ballots and its rules limiting who can collect them. How's that going?
Well, I've not been following that litigation very closely, but it's similar to litigation that we've seen across the country, where generally the Democrats are on the side of expanding mail balloting options, and the Republicans, or the Trump campaign, I should say more explicitly, are against it. Because, and why I have to say that is because there are Republican state governments and Republican state election officials who have expanded mail balloting, and they're finding themselves be the target of lawsuits from the Trump campaign and from the Republican National Committee. So it's a very strange situation to see what most people would consider to be the safest way for us to vote in the midst of a pandemic, and for even Republican state elected officials to agree with. And some of these are Trump supporters too. These are not some Republicans in name only. These are very much Republican state elected officials who are siding with the need to have safety during the pandemic, and on the opposite side of the Trump campaign and the RNC.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael McDonald, who's a professor of political science at the University of Florida. He's a principal investigator on the Public Mapping Project, a project to encourage public participation in redistricting. And he's also the director of the United States Election Project. Well, the other little nugget in the Axios article, where the Axios reporter spent some time traveling with House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, and he told the reporter that he had basically tried to convince Trump to lay off on or ease up on his campaign to try and discredit mail-in voting, because they were really relying on the senior vote. But there's also a little nugget in here which I want to run by you. The article also says that Trump trashes mail-in voting in part because he sees the messaging as a good cover if he loses to Biden in November, sources close to the president's re-election campaign tell Axios. What do you make of that?
Well, it's something I've been saying too, but really trying to divine what Trump thinks is a real difficult challenge for anybody. But it does seem like that there are two motivations for Trump to disparage mail balloting. One is identifying a scapegoat for an election loss, if indeed he loses. And the other is to provide cover to Republicans who may wish to follow the president and make it more difficult to vote by mail, because there's still some opportunities out there for states to change the way in which they're going to conduct the election. And there's still lawsuits that are out there. And so Trump is making some messaging claims to really try to get support behind his position that Republicans need to oppose mail balloting. And then related to that is that if Democrats are voting by mail, and Trump can say, hey, that's fraudulent voting, you need to take action, that's ripping a page out of the Democrats' playbook, where Republicans have implemented suppressive laws, at least in the Democrats' mind, and the Democrats use that as a messaging strategy to make people outraged and help drive up turnout by framing the election as the other side attempting to take your rights away from you and trying to subvert democracy. So I think what he's doing serves some messaging for him. And that messaging may also affect voter mobilization efforts on the Republican side. But at the same time, it's counterproductive. Some of the messaging he does on this is just flat out counterproductive. Like when he was saying, oh, if you vote in North Carolina by mail, you should go to the polling locations and check your, see if your vote's been counted. It was accepted and vote in person. Well, you know, you can check your status or your ballot online. That's the best thing for you to do. But actually flooding polling locations on election day, that's when a lot of Republican voters are going to be voting. Most of the Democrats are going to be voting by mail. So you don't want to flood the polling locations with lots of people gumming up the lines on election day. And so, yeah, sometimes it doesn't seem like there's a lot of strategic consideration if you just scratch the surface just a little bit on his comments and you think more deeply, well, what would this actually do if people were following his advice and showing up at polling locations who had already voted in person to check if their ballots had been accepted? It's probably going to hurt the campaign, not help them. And likewise, if you think more generally about what his own campaign is doing and McCarthy, what he's been saying to the president, they know that this is hurting them, that Trump's rhetoric is hurting them. And they're looking for some way to convince him to soften his tone so that they can have a better chance of winning the election.
So the fact that these prominent Republican senators like John Thune of South Dakota, Rob Portman of Ohio, Rick Scott of Florida, Mitt Romney of Utah, of course, he's not a favorite of Trump's, they're all going very public about their support for the integrity of mail-in voting. If Kevin McCarthy's weighed in on Trump to try to convince him, do you think any of those have, well, with the exception of Mitt Romney?
Well, someone did because he changed his rhetoric on Florida. So someone's been able to get through to him. I don't know who it was, but someone was able to do it. And I can't imagine that the pressure is stopping from that one person who is able to change his viewpoints on Florida. But, you know, again, it's very difficult to get Trump to change his mind on anything if he thinks that, you know, it's to his advantage somehow. And so I don't know what tactic or what message that someone managed to convince Trump about Florida, what they said, but hopefully they can repeat that for other states. I mean, if you're a Republican, because this could affect, the election results, not just in Florida, but in other states too, if Trump doesn't change his tone. And, you know, more importantly, we live in a democracy, and our democracy exists because we believe that our elections are free and fair. And if you undermine that to a large extent, then that undermines our democracy and doesn't serve really the interests of the United States to have the legitimacy of our election process questioned so deeply. So there's a much better, you know, bigger issue here. And let's just hope that we can get through all of this and reemerge afterwards stronger than we were before.
Well, Dr. Michael McDonald, it's not just Donald Trump that is beating the drum against mail-in voting. It's also the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr. He had a very contentious interview on CNN with Wolf Blitzer the other day talking about this. And by the way, he also made some statements recently. And then the Justice Department had to come out with a press release saying that the Attorney General was given the wrong material to base his remarks on, which is pretty extraordinary that the Department of Justice, which is full of lawyers, could make those kind of mistakes. But that aside, Barr is trying to make the distinction between absentee voting and mail-in voting, saying, well, in absentee voting, you know, they send the ballot, you request it, and they send it to your home. Whereas with mail-in ballots, they just go to the voter rolls and then send everybody out a ballot. And if the voter rolls are wrong, then you have fraud. Now, the senators, the Republican senators I just mentioned a minute ago, they all say there's no problem. But does Barr have a leg to stand on in any way with these arguments?
Well, yes, it's true that there are other people that are supporting the president and they follow his lead. And unfortunately, one of them is the Attorney General of the United States. His statements about 1,200 votes that were supposedly cast by one individual by the mail were wildly inaccurate, and the Department of Justice had to walk them back after the attorneys who were involved in that case said that that's not what happened. This was something else. But it's, you know, the Attorney General hasn't just parroted Trump's talk on that case and supporting Trump's positions. He's also said that we could have foreign influence in this election by having foreign governments somehow print ballots and have them sent to election offices, when that's not at all how the process works. Just not at all. And there's virtually no way that that can happen. The way in which they're describing it, is it, you know, possible someone intercepts someone's ballot and votes for it, you know, remotely? That's possible, but that can't be done on a widespread basis where somebody's printing ballots in mass and sending them to election officials. There are just too many safeguards and there are too many complexities in the process for something like that to go undetected. And yet, both the president and the attorney general have made these allegations that this is something that could happen in the election. As I said before, I just hope that we can get through this, that that people who will critically think about these allegations and think through them before they accept them as fact, because our democracy depends on people having confidence in the system. And even Republican elected officials, these are not wild Democrats, these are Republicans, who have said the system has integrity and there are checks to prevent these sorts of things from happening. So please listen to the people who actually know what they're doing. These are election officials. They are Republicans in some cases. They have supported Trump in the past in the 2016 election. They find themselves at odds with him over this one piece of important, critical piece of information. But there's a reason why. These are the experts. These are the people who know what's going on.
Well, just in closing, is it also the fact that a lot of rural voters vote by mail and they're getting it a double whammy from Trump because he's through his appointed postmaster general? They're obviously trying to interfere with the efficiency of the mail, and we don't know the extent to which they'll succeed. But given that rural voters are also going to be impacted, and they tend to vote Republican, and they also tend to rely on the post office. So is Trump shooting himself in the foot there as well?
Well, so just public service announcement for mail balloting, so we understand what's really going on here. Look, if you request your mail ballot now, election officials will send that mail, that ballot into the mail the first opportunity they get, which will be well in advance of the election. North Carolina just sent out their ballots on Friday, and already voters have received them and have returned them to election officials. So we're not in an apocalypse. The mail has not stopped. You're going to get your mail if you request your ballot now. The problems with slowness of the post office, we'll be able to monitor this. And there's going to be states like North Carolina is already doing it. Other states are going to be posting their data. I'm tracking this data very closely through the U.S. Elections Project. And we'll be able to see if there are some problems out there, if maybe rural jurisdictions, counties are returning their ballots later, if they're getting back into the system later. We'll be able to see that in real time and know if there are real problems here. I would say, though, if you wait till the very end, and you have to request a mail ballot at the very end, you're probably best off, if you do receive your ballot through the mail, you're probably best off returning it in person. And anybody can do this. There are lots of in-person return options. It might be a drop box in your state. It could be at the local election office, even some polling locations in some states. So always check with your local election officials about where you can return the ballots. But if you're really, really, really at the very end of the process and you're going to request a mail ballot and you're right at the very deadline for requesting ballots, probably your best option is to vote in person. And even if your state doesn't have an in-person early voting option, and you're going to be away on election day, and this is an emergency situation, election officials still have procedures that allow people to cast and request an absentee ballot at their offices and for those emergency situations. So even at the, it's really those people at the very, very end of the process that we are worried about most in terms of any slowing of the postal service. Those people, I would encourage you to vote in person instead of trying to vote a mail ballot if it's going to be too long to get that mail ballot back to you in time to cast a ballot.
Well, Dr. Michael McDonald, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Yeah, good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael McDonald, who's a professor of political science at the University of Florida. He's a principal investigator on the Public Mapping Project, a project to encourage public participation in redistricting. And he's also the director of the United States Election Project. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate. where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.